Hello, everyone, and welcome to Longevity Post Podcast number 3. I am your host, Scott Chaveri. Motivational quote of the day: whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it is time to pause and reflect. Mark Twain. I am joined, as always, by the immortal hair himself, Brian Simonis. Brian, how are you doing today?
Doing really well, Scott. How are you?
I am fantastic, thank you. All right, so this is our third podcast, Brian, and in the first two, we've discussed your supplement regimen on immortalhair.org, importance, some extraneous factors that can drive hair loss, such as heavy metal toxicity. We talked about some supplements you might want to take to, and some things you might want to do to mitigate heavy metal toxicity. So today, I thought we'd get back to the basics and talk about something simple, and that would be diet. So questions, the discussion today I want to have with you are, you know, what are some dietary causes of hair loss? What are some things that people should be mindful of in avoiding? And then also, what are some things that people might want to add into their diet that might help the issue?
Okay. Yeah, these are really interesting questions. And so, you know, a lot of people have approached me over many, many years, and, you know, they say, is there anything that I can include or exclude from my diet that might or may not influence my hair in some way? And so, you know, the first thing some people may have heard about is that there are extreme forms of allergic sensitivity to, say, gluten, you know, known as celiac disease. Now, this is generally thought to be a 1% issue for people. But there's really a new paradigm really called non-gluten sensitivity, or I should say non-celiac gluten sensitivity. In fact, if you were to ask me what is my opinion on what is the cause of this, because if you look at history, 30 years ago, we weren't really seeing the alarming gastrointestinal distress and many other strange phenomena occurring as we are today.
When you say strange phenomenon, so not just celiac disease, but other things like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis and other kind of autoimmune bowel issue type things, are you referring to those, or are you just talking about the prevalence of celiac?
So yeah, I'm really actually talking, Faith, let me sort of back up on that question and address a little bit about the basic celiac disease. So celiac disease is where you have, there's gliadin, which is a polymer of wheat, and basically it's a protein. And people in the 1% simply cannot tolerate gluten. So what will happen is they'll have a profound intestinal inflammation, and they'll have just all kinds of problems. And actually, some people are so sensitive to the gluten, they can actually have hair loss just with a slight, you know, just with a mere fraction amount of this small amount of polymer in their food, you know, and it's so difficult to avoid this because you can have a factory that's producing food that might not have any gliadin or gluten in the product, but it might just be there by contamination. So it doesn't take very much to trigger an autoimmune reaction, if you will. In fact, to put it in a simple way, is there is sometimes the body recognizes a wheat polymer as sort of a form of a yeast, and it sort of attacks it immunologically because of the chemical resemblance. But this is a relatively rare thing for most people. So we're going to really cover something what's called non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So if one were to ask me what is really going on here, why is there so many people, not just with ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, various forms, IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome, which is really a loose term that says, we don't know why you've got an inflammation in your gut, you just have it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's a couple of, here's some cortisol to suppress it, or here is some, you know, some antibiotics, let's see what we can do, and let's roll the dice and see what happens to you. But actually, we're also seeing other things. We're seeing a high level of autism, we're seeing a high level of neurological, we're seeing a lot of, you know, I say neurological, I see a wide different anomalies of neurological disturbances. You can call it ADD, ADHD, you know, attention deficit, depression, anxiety, just a whole multitude of different of challenges that weren't really being observed 30 years ago so much.
Okay, so this is, and to connect the dots a little bit, so this would be kind of the gut-brain axis, right? So the idea that disturbances in the gut can actually change how the brain functions, right? Like, I mean, that's the connecting the dots between, you know, something like Crohn's disease and perhaps something like anxiety, for instance, right? I mean, there could be... So even though the impact is neurological, the root or the root cause could be something wrong with the gut microbiome.
Exactly. So there is that thing you touched on, which they refer to as the gut-brain axis. And so, now by the way, Crohn's is a little bit different. You know, I can simply say there is something that's called Jones disease, which is found in cows. And Jones disease is sort of the human equivalent of, or rather Crohn's disease is the human equivalent of Jones disease, which occurs in cows. And there's a pathology involved with that. And but I should say, you know, if you sort of exclude the ulcerative colitis and the Crohn's, which are somewhat unique,
okay.
I will simply say this, though, that diet absolutely does affect these conditions. And it affects conditions outside of the ulcerative colitis and the Crohn's. But yes, as you said, the gut-brain axis is profound because... You know, your gut is, they say, the second brain,
right?
And you've got literally so many gut microbes that they do everything from provide the nutrition, they create the vitamins, they detoxify your body,
right.
They also help interfere with steroid hormones, they affect the ability to regulate your mood, they can even detoxify heavy metals. There's just a profound influence that your gut microbiome has, which is the composite of all the different species you have indigenous into your gut. When you take an antibiotic, for example, you're particularly at early ages, you're wiping out strains that may never recover. And this could regulate your ability to ward off hay fever or seasonal allergies or whatever influences may happen with that. So it's a very fundamental thing to your immunity. So that can influence your hair. But there is one thing that I think that's very prevalent. If you rewind the clock back to, say, 1976, that's about the time that a company introduced a wide level of herbicides, which they were heavily spraying. And these herbicides were, you know, they soak into the plant. And the thing about these herbicides that practically all of us, if you eat at a restaurant or if you eat any type of processed food at your local supermarket, you're likely to have a lot of food that contains herbicides. And what these things do is they disrupt your liver's ability to detoxify. They disrupt something called a P450 enzyme cascade. Mm. This also affects what is called the shikimate pathway in your gut. The shikimate pathway is something that regulates a whole number of detoxification. So there seems to be a wide body of emerging evidence that suggests that everything from autism to ADHD to ADD to a wide number of neurological anomalies, Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, Pick's disease, Parkinson's disease, and so forth, are influenced in some way, you know, from this relationship with your brain, your gut, and the food that you're eating.
Okay, so... are you referring to the research done by Dr. Stephanie Seneff from MIT? Does that ring a bell? I know I've read some work that she's done on glyphosate in particular in terms of the impacts that it has to the P450 enzymes and the impacts that it has on the gut microbiome. And she connects the dots between glyphosate and a lot of the modern diseases that you reference. So I don't know if you're referring to her research in particular or if there's a wider body of research out there, but I guess if folks or listeners out there wanted more information, I would definitely search for Dr. Stephanie Seneff and read her work.
Yeah, so there's actually some other individuals that predate Dr. Stephanie Seneff's research. What she did is she really took the work of Don Huber and also work of another individual, and really just expounded on the relationship of the data.
Okay.
So Don Huber is a plant biologist, and he seemed to be really one of the first people that touched on, you know, some of the dangers. And what Dr. Stephanie Seneff did is she used her own interest in biology and researched, you know, deeper, and really unearthed a lot of interesting things. So she wrote a journal of entropy, which pretty much expounded on some of the problems. There's actually a lot of research on this topic and the overall effects that what we call an herbicide known as glyphosate or glyphosate, however you want to word or term it, has on the overall human system. It was thought, at least by said manufacturers of this herbicide, they thought it was safe because it affects a pathway known as the shikimate pathway. And the shikimate pathway is not in human cells. However, it is found in microbes that are indigenous to the human gut, or at least I should say eventually transform into the human gut, you know, after the interaction between the mother and child as that flora starts to promulgate in the system. So
okay, if I can clarify, so this pathway, so this is the pathway, is this is how it kills plants? Does it disrupt this pathway in plants? Is that what you're saying? So, and it's not in humans, so they thought it was safe, but it is in certain microbes found in the gut. So if it kills those microbes, then it's still affecting us, even though the pathway is not found in us. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah. So essentially, what happens is you've got all these trillions and trillions of bacteria. We have probably anywhere from 70 to 100 trillion cells, you know, that are basically our gut microbiome, and they really outnumber us 10 to 1. And so what they do is they help us detoxify, they form you know, beneficial substances in our body. They really interact with us on such a profound way. And sort of evidence of that is when you take certain types of antibiotics known as fluoroquinolones, they can sometimes cause wide deepening disruptions in the body. It's sort of like when you're wiping out these gut microbes, you're also wiping out part of yourself, because there's sort of a symbiotic relationship between the two.
Right.
The way this herbicide works is it sort of has a chelating effect, meaning chelation means claw. It sort of binds to certain minerals. The effect of the herbicide is that it starves the, you know, what it's really aiming at, obviously, is the weeds. So it's trying to destroy the weeds' ability to assimilate nutrition. And the idea now is that they have genetically modified plants to be what they call Roundup resistant or glyphosate resistant, so that the mineral binding or chelating effect is going to starve the offending weeds more so than the plant itself. However, there is significantly less minerals and nutrients that are even in the plants with the herbicide sprayed. In addition, there's lots of residue of this herbicide that's sprayed onto the plant. So when we eat these foods, we're also ingesting these foods. And some of these foods contain substances that literally affect a lot of things in your body, namely the shikimate pathway, disrupting liver enzymes, and literally affecting so many processes in your body that ultimately transcend to your mood and things that ultimately can affect your hormone system, how it's regulated, and ultimately your hair.
Okay. So to kind of to translate this into actions, because we've talked about a few different things here. We've talked about antibiotics, and obviously the impact that the obvious impact they can have on the gut, and then glyphosate, and then the obvious impact that it can have on the gut. So for people that want to avoid, so for antibiotics, is the recommendation simply to buy grass-fed meat or an organic grass-fed meat, organic free-range chicken, stuff that's specifically labeled to have been raised without the use of antibiotics. Is that the and then what about supplementing probiotics? Do you recommend that as well?
Yeah, so I would say everyone's going to have different access to, you know, the best foods that they have available. So unfortunately, especially in today's world where a label that might be claimed to be perfect or clean or, quote, all natural, which often is not really true all natural.
It doesn't really mean a whole lot, all natural. Yeah.
Right. So you really just have to use your own due diligence, or, you know, how passionate you are about the particular extent in which you want to go to get quality food. And, you know, just do the best you can to investigate to find what's the best way you can get good quality food. So in the case of meat, if you're a meat eater, you'd want to look for grass-fed beef or grass-fed anything or free range, you know, and, you know, sometimes those are loose terms, but, you know, that's one realm. But one thing that's going to really improve your health is looking at the effect of grains. But before we get into that a little bit, I'll sort of just touch on the fact that, you know, when you're eating chicken, when you're eating conventionally raised beef, you know, these are often infiltrated through of antibiotics. And, you know, that's also essentially surviving into you. So when you eat these foods, it's still affecting you as well.
Right. Okay. So another thing we should mention is often the conventional raised beef and factory farmed chicken are fed genetically modified corn or soy, which are typically Roundup resistant. So you are inadvertently getting a nice dose of antibiotics, but also probably getting a nice dose of glycosate as well, right?
So, right. In fact, Scott, I think you said something that you found in cord blood. There was a study that showed a remarkably high level of glycosate found in the cord blood of mothers, correct?
Yeah, I think it was a study done in Canadian. It was either cord blood or breast milk. I can't remember, but it was something along the lines of they found glycosate in 90% of the breastfeeding mothers or the pregnant mothers. So it was pretty fascinating. And then they retested them and they kept finding it. And the conclusion they came to is that the glycosate introduced into their system through the meat that they were eating indirectly, which is, you know, and in the U.S. at least, conventionally raised meat is fed a heavy dose of GMO corn and soy. And so I think that that's one of the things that people don't necessarily realize when the argument about whether or not genetically modified foods are problematic. It may not be the genetic modification at all that's the problem. It could be that these crops are genetically modified to be Roundup resistant, and so they're getting sprayed with a ton of glycosate, and it could be the glycosate that's the problem, right? So in terms of, actually, I pulled it up here, in terms of, you know, what are the most common genetically modified foods that people might want to avoid, they are soybeans. 93% of them are genetically modified in the U.S. Corn, 86%. Sugar beets, 95%. Canola, 87%, cotton, 93%, and Hawaiian papaya, 80%.
That's amazing, isn't it? So just avoiding those foods there or being more discerning on those foods is going to really go a long way. And there's even a type of corn, you know, where, you know, they say the BT corn, as they call it.
Right.
Stands for BT toxin, or a more complicated word to pronounce. Literally creates, as they say, a pesticide factory in the gut that causes the intestines of an insect to explode. So that's really getting into you, and it could cause holes or loose junctions, and that could literally, you know, create a higher prevalency of things like, there's different words, but they'll usually call it leaky gut syndrome. And when you have this happening in the human system, you're essentially getting proteins to go in, reaching the blood through the portal vein through the liver, and actually you're having undigested protein in there, and your body's going to literally try to digest that, and that could cause some inflammation right there. It can cause a whole number of crazy things to happen. Or your villi, which is your carpet shag-like system in the intestine, this can be systematically destroyed, and your ability to actually absorb certain nutrients, you know, could be drastically diminished.
Okay. Okay, so, you know, we can do our best to avoid some of the big offenders, you know, the corn and the soybean, et cetera. and we could do our best to buy high quality food. But let's face it, this stuff is everywhere. It's in the water. It's sprayed outside people's houses as they're trying to, and on their landscaping. It's and you know people unless you live in a bubble, you're gonna go out and eat it every once in a while at a restaurant. You're not gonna have the highest quality food. So obviously the first step is to avoid it as much as possible. But under the assumption that we're going to get exposed to it whether we like it or not, what can we do to mitigate the negative effects?
Yeah, in fact, going a step further, when you're drinking pasteurized milk from conventionally feed cows, you're also getting problems there. In fact, if you are gluten sensitive, for example, or you can even call it glyphosate sensitive, because the pesticides are there from the feed, that's going to transcend to some allergic activity. I've seen people switch from pasteurized grain-fed cows to grass-fed raw milk, and they have absolutely no problems whatsoever. So that can make a big, big difference in your fight. And one of the problems I personally have with pasteurized milk is pasteurized milk essentially destroys all the beneficial microbes that once existed and actually proliferate specific pathogenic organisms that survive the pasteurization process. So this is really why we see, particularly in children, higher levels of different dairy allergies or other phenomenon, everything from you've got runny nose, you've got just different typical childhood diseases you'll see, ear infections. A lot of things clear up when you suddenly remove this type of dairy, but when you put them on raw grass-fed milk, you don't see these kinds of problems.
So just so I'm clear, so again, so on in terms of avoiding glyphosate, you're saying the conventional pasteurized milk, in addition to some of the detrimental effects of pasteurization, there's also potential contamination of glyphosate. Was that the key message there?
Yeah, in fact, that's like even another thing on top of it. Yeah, so that's one thing you really want to avoid because it's a way to get really an unhealthy dose of things you simply don't want in your body. So I think that overall, the best way to avoid glyphosate is to avoid processed grains. So most processed grains are going to have some levels of these things, and this is something you really, if you're interested in your hair and your health, avoiding the grain foods as much as you can. Unless you discern to look at maybe what they call ancient grains or things that are more native that were, not your typical big agricultural produced varieties. For limitations, in the scope of our show, we can't get into too much detail. But the grains have their own problems. For the fact that they're stored for long periods of time, they develop mycotoxins, funguses, and various other problems. So it's not just the glyphosate. There's a wide variety of reasons that you might want to avoid these in your diet, as much as you can.
Okay, so we want to avoid processed grains. We talked about the antibiotics. We've talked about the glyphosate, avoiding GMOs for the sake of avoiding glyphosate. But again, so the question I was trying to get at that I'm hoping you can help me answer is accepting the fact that some exposure to glyphosate is just inevitable in our current environment. Is there anything people can do to mitigate it, right? To mitigate its harmful effects?
Yeah, so what's interesting about glyphosate is that it disrupts the transport of sulfur. Now, sulfur is so important to the human system. In fact, you really cannot exist without it. So one of the things that glyphosate does that's so insidious is it slows down the transport of sulfur. So if you increase your intake of sulfur, let's say if you take MSM, MSM is called methyl sulfonate methane. It's a good source of sulfur. This is one of the other supplements we were going to touch on in the last podcast, number two, but simply did not have the time. So MSM taken at 1 teaspoon per 45 kilograms of body weight, or 45 kilograms of body weight, or in pounds it would
About
be
100 pounds.
forever, exactly 100 pounds of body weight, 1 teaspoon. taking with plenty of water. This is going to give you a bit of insurance, if you will, against the ravages or of glyphosate.
And you want to take it with plenty of water because it tastes terrible?
Actually, it's a bit of a different situation. Yeah, it tastes absolutely horrible. On a scale of 9.9,
I know that.
I know.
I have some of that here. I have MSM crystals made from MRM, so I've just started taking this at your
yeah,
recommendation.
It's,
and
it's
it,
very
it is
different.
it tastes terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason the water is there is once the MSM and the water hits your stomach, it immediately combines with water, goes into the lymphatic system, and oxygenates the lymphatic system, and it does something called sulfate. Basically, sulfate or bind or basically makes something that's actively pathogenic into sort of, no longer a problem. So it really binds to things. It also binds to metals and other things, but it'll help actually neutralize the negative effects of glyphosate. So basically, the more sulfur you can pound down your system, you're going to get, some level of protection, because one of the things that you mentioned, Scott, earlier was Dr. Stephanie Seneff, and one of her passions is the subject of sulfur, the transportation of sulfur in the body, and why sulfation is so important in the body process. And if you look at everything from cancer to heart disease to diabetes and other things, you'll find a close relationship of sulfur and the lack there of sulfur and how, the overall health of an individual is compromised. So introducing more sulfur is going to somewhat compensate, for this herbicide.
Yeah, what I find interesting too is that, I had heard of MSM in the past, and MSM is, in the past, I've seen it in hair, skin, and nail supplements. Right, so I mean, I've known that it was beneficial for hair, skin, and nails health. I did not understand the whole sulfur connection and the detox connection whatsoever. So it really does seem like a kind of a 1-2 punch, and it does seem like something that if you're losing your hair, you should definitely consider adding to your regimen.
Yeah, I should mention something while we're on the subject of MSM is many people say, why not take it in a tablet? Why not take it in a capsule? And the reason is 85% of its bioavailability, its ability to absorb in your body and do all of the things you really wanted to, are not going to happen. So because it's very sensitive to any type of additive or filler or anything. So even the gelatin that forms the capsule or the tablet process, those things can interfere for the absorption. And the most important thing is that MSM has an ability to actually help dissolve scar tissue. This only happens, unfortunately, when it's taken in an unadulterated or non-contaminated form. Many sulfur products, or MSM products, if you will, contain hidden additives such as silicon dioxide. The reason they add silicon dioxide, even if it's not on the label, is that through their processing plants or contamination within their plant, there's going to be this stuff because it needs to kind of lay into the machines to sort of form the capsules. And so even if in a factory that produces the powder, there's probably plenty of this stuff laying around. And if you get even a little bit of silicon dioxide in there, it's going to disrupt the ability for it to absorb into your system.
Oh, okay. So this is the stuff that's necessary for the kind of the encapsulation process.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. It really allows the for the machines to actually use this stuff. It sort of is a binding agent. They call it, they're really flow agents is what they're called.
Right. Okay, interesting. Okay, well, so I've got the right stuff because I've got the powder here. The pure methyl, okay, I won't even try to pronounce it. MSM for short. Okay, so we've touched a lot on diet. So anything else that folks should avoid from a dietary perspective? Or did we hit the key... The key players that could negatively impact your hair?
Yes, well, a lot of people, of course, discuss diets. What is the best diet for hair loss, right? And, this is a bit of a controversial issue because, people have, various, some people just think that they have this whole thing called diet figured out. Now, I've looked at this issue for a very, very long time, and if you look at studies all the way back to the 1960s, they've really decided, actually based on several hundred thousand data points, looking at literally, hundreds of thousands of people's biochemistry all looked at together and how the influence of different foods affect each individual, they found that there's a big diversity in one's ability to deal with protein, fat, and carbohydrate. What we really found is that there's at least as many as 10 different individual metabolic types. You know, that is to say that one person, they can metabolize lots of carbohydrate and low fat. Or on the other extreme end, you can see someone that can deal with high level of fat, high level of protein, but not very much carbohydrate. And then for most of us, it's probably somewhere in the middle, you know. So you really have to decide, you know, how does food make you feel? Food sort of affects your hormones. So, and there are certain tests you can take online for free that'll kind of clue you into, you know, where in that scale do you fall in there. And, even in diseases such as cancer, diabetes, heart disease, of course, people, you know, one specific diet is not appropriate for every individual. You really have to discover for you what is appropriate. And a lot of times it's intuitive. So you can almost use your own intuition and say, how does food make me feel? But sometimes it does take a test to kind of, you know, get an objective viewpoint, because people do fall into kind of religions, if you will, in the diet.
Yeah, and I can attest to that from personal experience. You know, I have been a victim of, you know, my own dietary dogma, where I've read a few books and decided that this one, 60% fat and 30% protein, 10% carbohydrate was the optimal diet. And then when I actually tried to eat that way, I didn't feel that great. And then I noticed that, you know, maybe increasing my carbohydrate intake, particularly in the evening, that I slept better, that I felt better. So I had to really detach from the dietary dogma, if you will, and actually listen to my body. And it's paid dividends. So I would give that kind of general advice to folks as well. I would say don't get married to any specific dogma. You know, some people will be a hardcore vegan. You know, if you're doing it for animal rights reasons, that's one thing. But, I know a lot of vegans that they feel great for the first 3 months, but then afterwards they kind of go downhill. So, you know, you should listen to what your body tells you, right? I mean, it's kind of common sense, but for some people, you know, they get stuck in a certain belief system and they have a hard time getting away from it. So, so I would say my general advice would be to just focus on the quality of the food that you eat first and foremost, and then kind of worry about macronutrient ratios kind of it's like a secondary concern as far as I'm concerned. I think if you eat high quality foods, you'll kind of gravitate towards the right macros kind of naturally, right? You know, like if you're craving fat, maybe it's because you need some fat, right? I mean, in a lot of ways, your body is a lot smarter than you are, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, I really had, a similar situation to you, Scott, is I went all the way, you know, during a time in the early part of the 90s when, you know, steak was considered a dead carcass. And
you mean all the way vegan?
Yeah, I tried that for a little bit. Now, for me personally, I couldn't sustain it. And I know many people that feel wonderful on a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet, but I wasn't one of them. So, you know, I got to a point where I started asking questions. You know, maybe I should, you know, the dogma or the mantra at that time was carbohydrates give you energy. Well, for me, they didn't. They made me feel tired. They made me feel sluggish. And I just started literally just everything was just underpowered. I threw some meat back in my diet, and I always started waking up almost like, wow, you know, this is what was missing. So I started to question everything I read at the time. And when I really look back, and many of the books that I've read, I realized there's really no references, nothing to really establish credibility. It was all just based on conjecture or whatever. So I really started to look, you know, more discerningly at the information at that time. That was really my own road to my, you know, eventual turnaround in my health, which was a very long road.
All right, very good. Well, we're coming up on the end of the show. So, Brian, thank you as always. This has been very informative. You know, I wanted to cover diet because I do think that it is so fundamental. It's something that you can't ignore, right? When you're talking about your health and your hair loss, which are and the health of your hair, they're joined at the hip. So I wanted to, you know, get your thoughts on it and get your as much wisdom as we could out of you in 30 minutes or less. So thank you as always. For the folks that enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Facebook. Just search for Longevity Post. If you have any questions for the brilliant Brian Simonis, please go to the Longevity Post video channel on YouTube and just write your questions in the comments, and we will be adding a Q&A section to the podcast as we move forward. So Brian, thanks again, and folks, have an amazing day.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.